Welcome to the new Cyber Frontier, bringing you the latest news on the local Colorado economy and initiatives that focus on the development of cybersecurity economics. You don't have to be a computer or cybersecurity expert to get plugged in. Your host, Chris Gorog, brings it straightforward, asks the tough questions, and brings the cyber world to a level of understanding for everyone. Chris is personable and opens up with our guests on the issues we all would like to see addressed. You can find us on the web at www.newcyberfrontier.com. Now join our host as he introduces the topic for today's new cyber frontier.
Okay, my name is Andre Hinton, and I'm one of the professor here at one of the universities here in Colorado. I teach cybersecurity and computer forensics. I'm filling in today here at New Cyber Frontier for Chris Gorog and Abe Thomas. We have on the phone with us Chuck, and what's your last name, Chuck? Chuck White.
We have Chuck White.
Yeah, we have Chuck White here, and we're going to give Chuck a minute to kind of talk about his background, where he came from, talk about Fornetics, and you know, what the company is headed and what they're doing, and then we're going to get into some really, really good topics that I have set out. So without further ado, we'd like to welcome to New Cyber Frontier, Chuck White.
All right, Andre, thank you. I really appreciate it. You know, background myself, a great way to look at it is anything, any good technology, a company, an idea, it's got to have an origin story, just like a comic book character.
Right.
Myself, I'm a former Army officer, veteran of Afghanistan and Iraq, and you could say the genesis of key orchestration would be on top of the governor's palace in Kandahar in 2002, rekeying a PSC-5 Spitfire satellite radio.
Wow.
Which, ironically, some of the bandwidth management for that would be just down the road from you guys, but that's another story for another day. But point being, sitting on top of the governor's palace, rekeying the radio and getting shot at, saying, you know, probably a better way to do this.
Right.
That, you know, this is the, you know, and I put a pin in that for a little longer in the story. Serve in Afghanistan, serve in Iraq. I'm injured in the Iraq war. They tell me I can't chase bad guys anymore.
Right.
End up in a career where it would have me in everything from classified work for the U.S. government to, you know, implementing the, you know, the first multi-factor authentication solution that used one-time passcodes over text messages. In between, sort of went back and forth between government and commercial work, would eventually decide to try things on my own, start a company named Semper Fortis, and did a project for the Air Force in 2013 that was designed to test something called the Protected Tactical Waveform.
Okay.
By specification, 48 hours to actually do the entire, you know, satellite terminal rekey, we built what would be the prototype of key orchestration, known as a 30-day demo, lovingly, that actually implemented that exercise in about 20 minutes. And in that, we realized we might have inadvertently built a product. So, time, you know, you get to this, you know, like I said, the story, you build a company, you start the process. We started doing things in 2014, that leads us to 2015, and we really start moving forward. But, you know, that's gets you some history, you know, sort of the background, the fact that there is a strong, we've used encryption and anger, you know, thread to the entire team at Fornetics. We're not just folks who built a solution for encryption. We were the operators. We were the folks who were doing everything, you know, both sides of the cyber equation, offense and defense. And we were ultimately, when we built a solution with our understanding, our knowledge, and our experiences in mind, that would align the use of encryption and the use of encryption key management in particular as the engine to support that with what you're actually doing. For the satellite system, it was mission planning and the crypto key management systems. For what we do now, it's everything from multi-cloud for automotive customers to, you know, multi-level security solutions associated with the Joint Strike Fighter.
Wow. I'll tell you
it's pretty fascinating. creating, how we got there. But it's really everything in between that and the story that I think that really drives the conversation. And, you know, the idea that this crypto domain, if you think about it from like a domain model, like a sticks taxi view of the universe, this idea of aligning the crypto domain with other parts for whether cyber response or for just general, operations of a system, a DevOps type perspective, or even just for governance. It's the fact that making that available and putting in technology that allows users to treat encryption in a lot of cases like they treat identity, becomes a very powerful tool. It has some very interesting capabilities from a cyber resiliency and cyber defense. Maneuvering the network with crypto versus network configuration is just one way to look at it.
Well, I'll tell you what, you said a whole lot of words that are alert words here in cyber, especially on new cyber frontier that are like, your ears go up when you hear them. With you dealing with encryption, and I teach, cyber at a university, and I tell them about, the inception of encryption was way back in the medieval days when they take a person and write a message on their head. They shave their head, write a message, let their hair grow out, and then send them to send the message, right? So we've come a long ways in terms of encrypting messages and what you do and the solution you provide protecting, that communication, and creating that level of trust that your customer needs. And so I'll kind of guide, our conversation to talk about more, and I like to, in every single show, I really like talking about 20% of the challenges that we face and then 80% of the solutions, which is where you come into play. So the next topic on the show will be, talk to me a little bit more about industry challenges. I have down here, they want me to say problems, but I say challenges. Industry challenges when it comes to cyber as you see it.
So a lot of this is where technology advanced. And, looking at things, there was a great podcast you guys did recently of Secure Things about IoT security. And by the way, IoT is probably one of the biggest, shoes thrown in the works, in terms of, sabotage, not in a bad way, but, in understanding how it impacted the market. There's the veneer of cloud, which is really somebody else's data center. These challenges of, everything from your threats, your attackers are becoming more sophisticated. Attacks that were once the purview of, the good guys are now becoming more commoditized, and, things like supply chain interdiction have made their way out on the market. So people can, something can come to you already in a, for lack of better words, packed state or compromised state. But I think it's, you look at that one, like a root of trust issue. But if you look at across it, it's so many things are interconnected that your entire presence, it's neither completely centralized, kind of like a mainframe or some of the initial cloud offerings, or completely distributed, like, your PC. It's something in between, and everything has to communicate with everything else. And if you're dealing in a world where that represents how you interact with technology and that technology interacts with the world, you now have the challenge of how does that all work together? How do you align that? How do you implement the diamond model for figuring out what's really important for you so you can actually defend it? And that becomes a challenge. And it also drives the technology sort of in a direction for years where we were always about, things like, I was having a conversation with a friend who's one of the original writers of OpenSSL. Great guy, Tim Munson. Tim and I were having a conversation about fences a couple years ago, and the fact that NAT was like a fence. Mm-hmm. But now, with IPv6, as a underlying, there are no more fences. So network address translation goes away, and then you go with the actual idea that anyone can talk to anybody else. And people take advantage of it. Technology should take advantage of it. But it emphasizes as a risk that traditional technologies have sort of come in a position where they don't, you can't look at something like as just purely a firewall rule or an IDS, IPS rule. You got to consider, what it becomes far more data centric. And it's that transition from system-centric to a data-centric model where you're going to see a lot of these risks coming up. If you consider, you know, what like a ransomware attack does, it attacks data. It doesn't really, I mean, a system, it's just running operations on a system. And in some cases, it's not a particularly sophisticated encryption type attack. The sophistication is actually in the delivery system. But it's a data-driven exercise. So you have to look at the risks in this transition, because a lot of what we've done for years, a lot of we've built up, I would be willing to wager a lot of what you, as you've been teaching students and educating them in the space, you would see a transition years ago where it was about perimeter defense. And we talk about things like dwell time. Mm-hmm. And now you get into the entire thing, like, you know, was it the cyber kill chain? Mm-hmm. And everything else, but ultimately it gets into this thing where it's this data-driven exercise, because data is what ultimately it's all about. So how do you protect the data? And more importantly, how do you protect the data in such a way that you can still use it? Because that's another risk, because you could inadvertently, you know, in the process of making yourself secure. I had one person that I heard once in a, it was a, like an AtlantaCon thing, did this about 16, 17 years ago, where someone said the only secure system is one buried underneath a bridge. You don't want that either.
No.
Because if something's unusable, why use it?
Right. Absolutely. And I tell people all the time, I share with, you know, I have kind of this Hinton's hierarchy of trust. I'll share that with you. This is the time to share that. But it starts with people, right? Before you even have, you know, a device, you have to trust people with a device, right? I mean, a device that comes out of the store is still secure. It hasn't even been turned on yet. It doesn't turn itself on. You know, and it doesn't charge itself. At the end of the day, we as people, you know, have to develop that level of trust as well, right? And I've had, you know, numerous people on the show today, and one of the things that that we talked about was shrinking, you know, the attack surface. And some of the things that we have and some of the devices we have are just not going to be secure right now. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely.
They're just not going to be.
You can do things to, if you think about it, certain technologies are, and it depends on what your, even what your goal is in terms of securing it. Is it securing it for integrity?
Right.
A lot of devices and sensors in IoT are not about confidentiality. They're about integrity.
Mm-hmm.
Or are we looking at it, you know, or are you looking at it for just the fact that, you know, because of the way these systems were set up, you have to consider how you establish enclaves that those things can act well, they can be insecure in a secure enclave, for lack of better words. And it's a lot of it is particularly when you consider things that don't get regular software updates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything from, you know, anything you could make an argument, anything in handles like layer 4 and below the OSI stack.
Right.
These are things that have a tendency to have a longer mean time to failure, and from a traditional, you know, technology perspective, but also other systems. I mean, think about us, the, you know, our utilities, you know, the grid, our water infrastructure. These are things that we built the last 30, 40 years. Now we've put some, we can do our technology that allow you to put sensors in. If you can put a technology on, that means you can, you know, orchestrate it, which of course is great for me. But that also means that in that transition, how did that work? And in so many cases, we do try to, you know, bolt on a solution in these, for these insecure technologies, and you inadvertently create an attack surface.
Right.
You know, you can't hack a typewriter.
Right.
You can hack a typewriter that has some sort of network interface associated with it, though.
Right.
So
absolutely.
It's a, you know, It's noting that. It's noting that these. But then the question is, sometimes the answer isn't technology.
Mm-hmm.
Probably bad for a technology vendor to say that, but
right.
Oh, there it is. Sometimes
you're
the
right.
Answer is process.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, at the same time, you can hack a typewriter by shoulder surfing the typist, right? Maybe
or,
it's not.
Or taking them out for drinks.
Yeah, there you go.
Talk to you.
Right.
Oh, counterintelligence 101.
Yeah.
You know, get someone drinking and get them talking. You know, it's but you're right. That's how, and hacking the person sometimes another part of all this.
Absolutely.
And in many cases, no matter how secure the system is, if the person themselves, you know, maybe because they were bragging about their job at the NSA, and someone from, let's say, Russia sees that and gets them all riled up on senses of liberty and freedom, and then they sit there and spill secrets.
Absolutely. Well, real quick, my name is Andre Hinton. I'm here with New Cyber Frontier, and I'm here with Mr. Chuck White. I'd like to take a second for our sponsors, because that's how we pay our bills out here and pay for the coffee and donuts or bagels or whatever we get. So without further ado, we'll just take a second for our sponsor. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities designed to prevent members from attack. Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
Dre Hinton, I'm here with New Cyber Frontier. I'm here with Chuck White of Fornetics, and I'm Andre Hinton filling in for Chris Gorog and Abe Thompson here at Secure Set, and they're letting us use their building. I'd like to give a shout out to them. Thank you for letting us use your amazing facility out here to host this podcast. And we're going to get right back to our podcast real quick with Chuck. Hey, Chuck, welcome back.
Great, thank you. Hey, Andre, once again, it's great being here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so where we left off, we were kind of talking about some of the challenges we're faced with. So kind of like moving towards more of a solution, and your forte, which is encryption, and which from the DOD, in the DOD world, encryption's like, you know, a word that's out there in front. They feel like if it's encrypted, then we're good to go. It's no worries. You know, it's the, you know, the message was encrypted. We're good. What are you talking about? So talk to us a little bit more about solutions to how we're doing business from, you know, a computing perspective, and how the solutions you provide or you see provided in encryption.
Great. Thank you. And, you know, when we consider encryption, let's consider the fact that technologies, whether it's everything from a hard drive to a tactical radio, they all use encryption keys in one form or another. And that you know, if you talk, you know, some like software development contract, you know, you use software development classes, you'll hear things called contract first development. That encryption key is a data contract. You know, it has a particular, it feeds a particular cipher, you know, whether it's a block cipher or a streaming cipher or whatever. It has an effect. Now, what's powerful is to invoke that is actually the management and federation and distribution of that key material. That key controls the encryption. No key, no encryption, or no decryption. You know, and that's so the way to look at controlling the nature of encryption is to control the nature of the management that actually drives the encryption keys to those systems. You have that, you've actually have control of the encryption. It's an interesting model, much like an identity. You can't assert an identity unless it's there to be asserted against. This concept is, and it's systemic in any technology that uses this, not just for, you know, encryption and decryption, but also other things like signatures, you know, hashes, MACs, all these, you know, machine authentication codes. These are all things that are driven. The key has to be there in some capacity to facilitate that behavior. Now, the challenge is that you're dealing with lots of different technologies, and how do you, in one sense, have something that's pure play to manage or orchestrate encryption technology, and at the same time is diverse in terms of the spider web that it facilitates of all these various technologies that need or are driven as part of their security, whether everything from IoT to network, you know, any like MACSEC or IPSEC, you know, network infrastructure, to blockchains, or even, you know, transmission security or communication security and stuff that the Department of Defense really cares about.
Right.
There's all these. So the trick is, how do you do that? What the complexity is that on top of that, an encryption key has its own life cycle. It's not like an identity where you are. I am Chuck, and you're Andre, or you either are Andre or you are not. Right. You are either authenticated or you are not. An encryption key per NIST 100-57, this is to protect it from hurting you, has a, you know, a pre-active state, an active state, you know, a revoked state, an archive state, a destroyed state, a compromised state, can cover a bunch of those simultaneously. But the idea being, this is even a destroyed compromise. Just destroyed the key, but it was compromised. The record keeping thing. But point being, that structure is to, you know, be able to sort of a state model that helps provide governance. And you have to be able to apply that to all these varying technologies at different degrees, because they all have their own business rules. And if you perhaps get it wrong, you could inadvertently, you know, be sort of ransomwaring yourself. You get it right, you can maneuver the network of cryptography in the same way for defense that you saw, you know, those sort of those crypto weapons doing things on networks for offense. And that's a very, very powerful way to address threats. You know, if you're getting hit by ransomware, what's faster? Mm-hmm. Changing a whole bunch of network configuration rapidly, or simply switching out some keys so that your, you know, your given IPsec tunnel on a site-to-site VPN doesn't work anymore because, hey, you just changed one of the keys and the site is still safe.
So,
and when you're done, put the key back.
So a lot of our members aren't even, or the people or listeners aren't even connected to a company, right? A lot of, I'd say more than half of our listeners just want to hear about cyber and how they can get involved and new ideas and what's available. Now, from a personal perspective, I'm talking about at home, and we, you know, Chris does this a lot too. How can something that you do protect what I do in my home?
That's a great question. And what we're seeing is the beginnings of key management as a service.
Okay.
And that allows you to have the same type of protections that you would have for an enterprise being deployed to the individual level. You know, because, you know, if you think as you as an individual, you might have key, you might have keys associated with your a self-encrypted drive. You might have PGP keys that you're using for your own personal web of trust. You want to be able to have, you know, the ability to store, protect, access in such a way with appropriate mandatory access controls if you are indeed the only person that can do this, or share with people that you seem to deem to be appropriate. And that denotes a need for a very, very strong set of discretionary and mandatory access controls to allow key management to actually facilitate that type of behavior. And that's something that's something where you see that, where some people just want their keys. Mm-hmm. They don't really care about the management or the governance pieces. They say, "Do you have a key for me? Yes, please." And that's part of it. That's how you get to the individuals. How do you do it? And even if you don't use a technology like a key management for service, let's take that one step back. Work with encryption. Do things like encrypt your hard drive. Do things like, you know, try to, you know, you can, you know, do things like use PGP, you know, things along those lines to encrypt your emails. Look for, you know, things like even when you download software, you know, a lot of folks will provide you, you know, like an MD5 hash for whatever, you know, for what the file is. Check those things out. Make sure they're legitimate. Because the thing is, sometimes the challenge in using this, you know, at the individual level to get access to this type of technology, there's things you can do on an individual level to use encryption more intelligently. Now, in time, you're going to see more and more of this reaching out at a much more, you know, I guess you would say, going from an enterprise type technology to a, you know, sort of like getting down into a small, medium business. And now what we're really talking about is the, you know, is the consumer level, when it reaches a consumer level, and it's on its way, because there's, you know, the areas where there's also, you know, like dealing with electronic health records, huge piece there. How do you protect your private information? How do you have control of your private information? And, you know, it's the idea of the goal to encryption, if anything, is it's one part, you know, having some nuance and understanding how it's applied. It's about 15 parts making sure you don't lose the key. Because if you lose the key, it's just as bad as, you know, might as well just go download the latest ransomware and just use it on yourself because you've just done the same thing. So, but that's. But the flip side is, the benefit of it is when you put it under control, when you use things. I mean, there's things like any number of technologies that you can use for password management. It can also be used for keys. If it's at that level where you can literally, if you have something, you know, put it in there, protect it, encrypt it, or at least, do something where, use those things to actually protect that information at the individual level. That's part of what you have to consider. Now, what you're going to start seeing is that you will have the ability to safely register and protect that data with a trusted third party so that in case something happens to you, you'll have that key material will be available. And that's really, from a consumer level, it's not just the protection, but availability becomes critical because you're not going to necessarily have an IT department running around who's going to help you restore your stuff. So if I had any guidance for the anyone who really wants to go down this path, there is a parallel. What's important to you? How do you protect it? And from there, how do you take steps to, what's important to you? How do you protect it? And from there, take steps to actually facilitate what you need to do to protect that key material.
Yeah, kind of like an implementation phase.
Side note, is there a beep coming across? I hope, is there a quick...
I don't hear it.
And one of my sales reps is calling me. So we'll do that one more time without the beep.
Sure, go for it.
What's important to you?
Mm-hmm.
How do you protect it?
Sure.
And then in light of that, what's important to you and how do you protect it? If encryption is indeed the choice, how do you protect the key and how do you make sure that key is available when you need it?
So one thing that came... Go ahead.
What?
I was going to say, one thing that came to me while you were speaking is almost a personal responsibility of protecting all of my personal data. And if that's the case, why not leave that responsibility up to me? If it's my medical data, why can't I be the sole person that's responsible for protecting that data? Why do I have to keep it exposed at the hospital?
That's a very easy, and the answer to that usually sits around the emergency room.
Right, absolutely. But it would be on a card that I protect, and I protect the key. You see what I'm saying? So if I'm in the emergency room, then my data travels with me. I mean, this isn't something that's happening, but I'm just throwing it out there.
So, and that's a great question. And as this technology becomes more available, you'll start seeing, and this is actually an interesting piece of, use cases for healthcare systems that are, implementing a no-trust type model.
Right.
To facilitate, but that no-trust model, the blockchain model, isn't necessarily there to protect the confidentiality of the record. It's there to protect the integrity of it. There is like a use case in New Jersey where, someone's going, hospital hopping to get narcotics, pain meds. Well, if you had a way way to see that, keeping records up to date, being able to do that integrity check, well, that's actually pretty powerful. Now, from a privacy perspective, in time, I think we'll get to a place where you have this almost like a shared data model, and you do like a split key, join key operation where a person provides their part of the key associated with their record, and that's how you get to it. That's also feasible type of technology we're talking about here. In the short term, it's funny. I actually have, to your point, there's things that you can do. Like I have my military medical records. I have an encrypted, thumb drive that I have that has them on them for the exact purpose that if I ever had to use them, hey, that's there, and then I have control of those records. As we get to, people who don't deal in encryption day in and day out, the people that from a cyber perspective we're all trying to protect, Where I think you'll see this advancing is this idea of using encryption much more for the integrity of records, because from a care perspective, that's the important part. If someone noted that you have a drug allergy for, like, let's say a particular type of anesthesia, and that you couldn't do an integrity check when you go to the ER and you get the wrong type of anesthesia, that's really where things happen. The confidentiality component's critical because you don't want people stealing your PII.
Right.
But, you know, I use the ER example for why do hospitals, so that when, you know, something bad happens to you and you get hit by a car when you're out for your morning run and you didn't have your medical records on you, they can still, you know, appropriately provide care. That's as much. And, you know, there's also, this will speak to another point, the social constructs of all these technologies. It's not the technology necessarily that would be the hard part at the end of the day. You could make the case that the actual more difficult part is the change in human behavior, the expectation that I, as the patient, have this personal private data that's very important to my care that I'm expected to have with me. You see where I'm going with this?
Yeah, I do. I was thinking, too, what if that key was part of a biometrics, of your biometrics? If it was, that key was connected to me physically, it was in my eyes, or if it was in my fingerprint, that key that exists that you're talking about to encrypt it, you couldn't have it unless you had me there. That's zero trust.
Exactly. Now, I would make the case, generally speaking, I think biometrics works great as part of a seed for encryption keys, but I'm always a little hesitant about anything that, you know, if it gets stolen once.
Right.
Re-key your retina.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can't re-key your finger. Like, I guess you could cut it off. if someone cuts your finger off and you're a multi-billionaire and you got the key to your cryptocurrency.
Wow.
That's getting pretty deep, but anyway.
But if we go down that path for a technology perspective, the biggest thing that you would need to see in the biometric space is more standardization around capture methods. Because you could, even from a usability perspective, you go to one thumbprint reader to another, if they don't consistently capture the image the same way, it's hard to do the proof points, you know, for to be able to say, hey, this 11 or whatever point saying that this is actually this is indeed that space, because two cameras could collect the same image differently.
I can make it a sequence. I could say, okay, thumb, thumb, finger, finger, thumb, finger. You know, I could make a sequence to where my key is almost like playing a piano, right? I mean, it's a password, it's biometrics that would be based on a sequence and no one would know it but me. Of course, if I forgot it, then that's a whole other
fair
thing.
And that would be, in that case, it would be like something you have and something you do.
Right.
You know, it goes back to multi-factor authentication.
Yeah, that's
which is
true.
A very smart thing
I'd have to do it. Right. So real quick, we're going to take a sponsor break, but when we come back, actually, we don't have to do a sponsor break, but what I will say is what we need to do right now is we're going to wrap it up because I hate to. We're going to have you back. I'm going to request that we have you back if that's something you would be willing to do. Would you be
absolutely
willing to come back?
Fun. Okay. I enjoy this.
Yeah. Okay, fantastic. Well, you'll get an email from Miriam asking what your schedule is if you can actually come back, and we'll request that you come back and do this again for us. But in the meantime, what I'd like for you to do is give us a little bit more information about what you do have to offer as solutions as Fornetics, and just give us some information on how people can get a hold of you if they need your services.
Sure thing. So, a couple different ways to contact us. We have the capacity for, you can buy from Fornetics directly. We have resellers and partners who you can buy through them. So we do have multiple, you know, I guess you'd say channels to be able to sell our technology. First step, I would say, if you take any interest in Fornetics, go to our website, https://www.fornetix.com. Go take a look. We have an information page. It's net queries. We have a pretty cool blog where we write about topics, not always necessarily promoting Fornetics key orchestration, but general ideas. We like, it's part of that knowledge share, you know, philosophy. It comes from people who've had to use encryption in anger. Other place, you know, if you want to use a landline, It is, our phone number is 1-844-KEY-ORK. That would be K as in Kilo, E as in Echo, Y as in Yankee, O as in Oscar, R as in Romeo, C as in Charlie, and H as in Hotel. And if you happen to not have a phone that has the actual number of letters associated for it, that is 1-844-539-6274. We definitely, lots of stuff to read up on the page. Our technology providers, what we provide, we have, of course, the key orchestration appliance. That's sort of this crypto brain for an enterprise. And around it is these things like other things that speak, standards like key management, interoperability protocol, like an instant integration. VMware is like 3 minutes or less. Or technologies where we have orchestrators, which are effectively KNIP-driven proxies that allow us to do protocol transfers. So switch it from the standards body type board KNIP for key management, switch it to like an F5 or an Azure or, an Amazon. So it's this ecosystem of management. It lets you be able to take control of your crypto domain with automation, i.e. the ability to actually script out complex operations and scale with a real honest-to-goodness set of mandatory access controls. Not just role-based, attribute-based access controls, good old ABAC, that gives it to, lets you take control of your crypto, be a policy decision point for crypto. Very cool how that all ties in together. The result is you can do everything from tie into your SOC, your SIM infrastructure, tie into all these devices that need crypto, and if an event happens, you can say, key orchestration, execute cyber plan alpha.
Excellent.
It starts manipulating crypto on the network. And that's really when you see what orchestration is. It's orchestrating a business system, a security system, with the technologies that actually use crypto, and do it so you get predictable, repeatable, and events in a secure process. And that's that idea where you see it's not just one technology, it's multiple technologies. And, very big on, we did things like outbound logs or in common event format. Didn't have to do that, but hey, if you're going to in standards we trust. So there's a lot of the technology about how it actually works is designed to integrate. It was developed by integrators, and so we've got customers both in the government and defense industries as well as commercial, both here in the United States and abroad. It's one of the things where we really enjoy being able to support this vision of orchestrated encryption to be able to really provide value to customers and just ultimately be a resource. And then for those who are listening, if they have a question on crypto, they're more than willing to reach out to me. My email is chuck@fornetics.com, and love to hear from folks.
Oh man, I tell you what, thanks a lot, Chuck. My name is once again Andre Hinton. I'm here at New Cyber Frontier, and our guest here was Chuck White. I hope you didn't miss this podcast, because there's a lot of amazing information you provided for us. Chuck, thank you a lot for coming.
The views or opinions expressed during this podcast are not those of Colorado Technical University.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of New Cyber Frontier. Remember to get involved. Often we think that someone else will handle privacy and security in the virtual world, but you are the only one truly in command of your virtual fate. Join our mailing list so we can keep you informed of breaking news and new releases. If you have an idea, if you have a question that you would like to hear answered, or if you want to get involved with our efforts, reach out to us at newcyberfrontier.com. We also encourage you to visit our sponsors' links, as they are the ones that really make this show possible. I want to thank each of you for supporting the show, and we look forward to seeing you back for the next episode of New Cyber Frontier.